Welcome to the Hifor results for the 9 months to the 30th of September 2021. Throughout the call, all participants will be in listen-only mode, so there's no need to mute your own individual lines, and afterwards there'll be a question and answer session. Just to remind you, this conference call is being recorded. Today, I am pleased to present John Hollenkaye, Chief Executive Officer, Javier Echeverri, Chief Financial Officer, and Sally Ding, Director of Treasury and Corporate Finance. Please begin your meeting.
Apologies, I was muted, but I will now start. Welcome to all who joined us on our quarter three 2021 results presentation. It's a reminder that even after 18 months, we've still haven't got used to using Zoom and WebEx and Teams, and would much rather be doing this in person. But today we'll be presenting our key operational and strategic highlights, including progress on our three-phase plan in response to COVID-19, a review of our financial position, which I'll ask Javier to take us through, and then we will conclude by taking your questions. Turning to slide four, we've given an overview of our key metrics, and to be consistent with our half-year results, we'll continue to show quarter three results against the same period in 2019, pre-pandemic, and 2020. And as you know, the world is now starting to live with COVID, thanks to the rollout of the vaccinations and boosters. And while we remain vigilant for any changes to border controls in the UK or our major markets, we are starting to see traffic recovering as the UK and other governments have relaxed travel limitations. And you can see slide 10 has more details on this. We expect demand to continue to increase over the final quarter of the year, following the recent removal of PCR testing for doubly vaccinated arrivals into the UK, a reduction in the number of countries on the red list, and the planned opening of the United States. Revenue was down approximately 70% against 2019, £695 million. And we've continued to maintain control over the cost base, with operating costs at £578 million. As a result, adjusted EBITDA was £117 million in that period. Now, normally we focus on EBITDA as our main profit measure, but if you were to look at PBT, we made a loss over the 9 months of £1.1 billion, which takes our cumulative COVID losses to £3.4 billion. But the recovery in traffic and the cost control measures mean that our losses have reduced from around £5 million a day last year to around £3 million a day in quarter three. Moving to liquidity, our position remains strong at £4.1 billion, and earlier this month we successfully completed our £1.6 billion funding plan for 2021. And in August, our request for a waiver for the Heathrow Finance ICR covenant for 2021 was approved. And I'd like to thank everyone in the financial community, lenders and investors, for continuing to support Heathrow. So whilst the steps we have taken to protect the business over the last 18 months make us a more efficient and resilient organization, now is the time to look forward and turn our focus to winning the recovery and building back better. So on slide five, we just laid out our strategic priorities, which really haven't changed over the last few years. Our focus remains on operating a safe and resilient operation at lower costs while continuing to deliver excellent service to our passengers. With demand for flights increasing, we're working with all our Heathrow partners to ensure that our passengers feel safe and confident traveling through the airport. We're working through the CAA's initial proposals for H7, which were published last Tuesday, and will respond to the consultation in December. However, our aim is to reach a settlement which allows us to provide a great service to passengers and a fair return for our investors. On sustainability, we have a clear plan now to decarbonize aviation, and we are calling on the UK government to announce a jet zero package of legislation. And finally, although it may not be our immediate priority, we know that expanding Heathrow in the right way and at the right time will be essential to fulfilling the government's ambition of a global Britain. So moving to slide 7 to look at the progress on our business protection plan, starting with our FlySafe model. Safety of colleagues and passengers remains our top priority. As we're living with COVID and passenger numbers increase, we are gradually removing some of the social distancing measures, such as the one-way system across the terminals and the seat blockers, to ensure that we provide enough seating. But we are maintaining face coverings, enhanced cleaning regimes, and provision of hand sanitizer throughout the airport. And these are important measures for passengers and colleagues to know that they are being looked after. And we're very pleased that Skytrax has confirmed our COVID-19 four-star safety rating. On slide 8, we've just updated our comparison to other European hub airports. And you'll know that Heathrow has been lagging behind all other European hubs in terms of passenger recovery, largely due to the tighter travel controls that exist in the UK. And while these have reduced recently, we do still have tighter controls than other countries. So in the EU, there are no restrictions on travel to most of the major markets, no requirement for testing. The UK government still maintains a two-day antigen testing after arrival and a passenger locator form. And both of these are friction, which reduces the appeal for some people to travel. And until we see all of those restrictions removed, we're not going to see the market fully recovering to 2019 levels. And because we're operating with fewer flights than we have done, that's had an impact on cargo volumes. So cargo volumes are still 15% below where they were in 2019, which compares to Schiphol and Frankfurt, where volumes are actually up versus 2019. So as we turn to focus on winning the recovery, slide 9 provides a snapshot of our key markets based on the current travel requirements. And we use this, this is a summary of the data that we use for our traffic forecasting, which goes into a lot of detail on a country-by-country basis. And you'll know that the UK government has now moved from the traffic light system, which looked at a country risk basis, to one that is based on individual vaccination status. And that's something that we had been working with the airlines to encourage the government to do for many months, and we're glad that they've done that. And they also now recognize the vaccine status from countries which represent 95% of our markets. There are now only 8 countries left on the red list, which for which there's a requirement to quarantine in a hotel, and those are markets such as Colombia, the Dominican Republic, and Ecuador, relatively small markets for Heathrow. So when we take into account the travel restrictions imposed in the UK and by other countries, we can see that quarantine-free travel is now allowed with 65% of our markets, albeit with testing in at least one direction. And when the US opens up on the 8th of November, this will increase to 85%. The recent moves by Morocco to restrict travel from the UK and other countries does show the pandemic is not over yet, and this will affect passenger confidence. And we are encouraging the UK government to move to the same situation that exists in the EU with frictionless travel, removing the need for the day 2 antigen test and the passenger locator form. On slide 10, you can see how demand is starting to return. This shows the month-by-month passenger numbers for 2019, 2020, and 2021 year to date. And you'll see that following the lifting of travel restrictions, we've had a steady build-up in passenger numbers each month. We haven't seen the dip down after the summer that we saw back in 2020. And based on the forward bookings that the airlines are seeing, we are expecting a steady build through the end of this year. And certainly October currently is in line with our forecast. So this feels a much more solid recovery. We are seeing a much peakier level of business. So mornings tend to be busier than the afternoons. Weekends tend to be much busier than midweek. And some individual hours are very busy indeed. And that makes a big challenge operationally, because we have to make sure we have enough resource available to manage to the peaks rather than to the averages, so that we can have a steady flow of passengers through the airport. So we're working with airlines, handlers, and the government agencies to make sure we can stay ahead of demand. And we're now planning for Easter next year and for the summer peak to make sure we're recruiting and training people well ahead of that demand coming through. And you'll see that coming through in the cost forecast, which I'll come on to on slide 11, which just summarizes where we have got to. And you'll see that we are moving out of a phase where we've kept operating costs and capital expenditure very tightly under control. We've benefited from the swap reprofiling program, which reduced the interest paid in 2021. We still have a strong liquidity position, but we're starting to turn the taps on again with both operating expenditure and capital investment in quarter four. And the numbers we're showing here are the balancing number to get to the end of 2021 figures that we showed in the last investor report. And while I don't think we'll quite get to those levels, hopefully gives you an indication we are starting to invest now ahead of demand. And that's the right thing to do, and it's a sign of confidence in the recovery. Slide 12 just shows the status of our operations in the winter recovery phase. And you'll know that we've been operating with two runways since early summer. We are actually operating at around two-thirds of the air traffic movements that we would have had in 2019, so quite a significant increase in movements. And most recently, our passenger levels have been around 45% of 2019 levels, just over the busy October half-term getaway season. Terminal 4 is no longer operating as a dedicated facility for arrivals from red list countries, and we're getting that ready so that if the demand comes back, we can bring it on for serving passengers as quickly as possible. Originally, the lead time for that was about 6 months, and we're working to get that down by investing some of the capital that we need to get that ready a little bit quicker. And that just gives us a bit of versatility in case demand comes back more quickly than we have planned for. So that's where we are with winning the recovery. In terms of the third phase of our plan, building back better, I'll start with carbon on slide 13. And I'm really encouraged with the progress that is being made in the UK and internationally with decarbonizing aviation. This isn't just about what happens on the ground, but you might remember that we became carbon neutral at Heathrow on the ground back in early 2020. That means all of our energy is sourced from sustainable fuels, and we are offsetting any of our residual emissions and working to remove them altogether. We've also started to see the shift towards sustainable aviation fuel. We were the first airport in the UK to integrate those into the normal operation. That's been a big success. We are working around COP to make sure that all the planes to COP from Heathrow will be powered by sustainable aviation fuels, working in partnership with BA and BP. That's a really important proof point that SAF is a reality now and is going to be part of the solution. But some of the bigger changes are taking that to a more national level and then to a more global level. So last week, the government announced as part of its net zero strategy that it would be investing nearly £400 million in partnership with the Gates Foundation in creating sustainable aviation fuel plants here in the UK. And they set an ambition for 10% SAF by 2030. Now, that's a really good step forward and shows a strong statement of intent. What we want them to do is to turn that into a mandate that legally requires 10% SAF by 2030 and then a progressive increase through to 2050, and a price support mechanism, such as contracts for difference, which would help to bridge the cost gap between SAF and conventional kerosene. And that would just stimulate the take-up in the marketplace as quickly as possible. And that's a mechanism that's been used very effectively by the government with solar and wind. So those are the policy measures we are calling on them to make. But COP26 is also an opportunity to make that a global position. And we're encouraging the government to show leadership, getting other governments on board, so that when we come to ICAO, General Assembly, in September 2022, which is where aviation is governed under the UN, we'll be able to get a global agreement to decarbonizing aviation. And we're delighted that IATA, the global aviation trade body, committed to net zero aviation just a few weeks ago. It's a fantastic sign of leadership from IATA. So let me come finally for this section onto the regulatory update following the publication of the CAA's initial proposals. And this is on slide 14. So this is the first time we've seen a detailed response from the CAA to a number of submissions that we have made over the last 2 years. And clearly, we're in a very uncertain time during that two-year period. A lot has changed, and it's going to take longer to settle on a sensible settlement than we would all have originally anticipated. So the CAA is seeking responses by the end of this year and will publish its final decision in 2022. And financeability will be a key issue, especially the ability to generate enough cash flow over the next few years to meet our financing obligations, but also to ensure that we can fulfill the workings of the RAB-based regulation, the return of the RAB, and a fair bet on the return on the RAB, and that's what we're looking to achieve through the settlement. The CAA has recognized that lower passenger numbers, the very high fixed costs that we have to run the airport, and the higher cost of capital mean that after 8 years of falling prices, there will be a step up in charges. They presented a range of outcomes on the key building blocks and a range of potential prices. In some areas, such as operating costs, commercial revenues, and capital investments, they're seeking further evidence. They proposed a risk-sharing mechanism on passenger numbers, which would mitigate the effect of any future pandemic-style event. And you may have noticed a significant gap between our forecasts and the CAA's for some of the major building blocks. We are assessing these in detail, but from our first look, some of the numbers just don't make sense. So a few examples. On the cost forecast, based on the consultant's assumption that we can operate a 46 million passenger airport with two runways and four terminals in 2022 at a lower cost than we operated a two-terminal, one-runway, 10 million operation in 2020, but without the benefit of furlough and temporary cost reductions, which just makes no sense. On commercial revenues, their consultants have assumed that Heathrow, which already has the highest spend per passenger of any airport in the world, will be able to grow it faster than we have ever done, even though we've lost the benefit of VAT free shopping, which makes no sense. And on the passenger forecast, their consultants have assumed that airlines will have a higher load factor than they have ever achieved, even though they have always focused on maximizing returns rather than load factor, and that is true today if you look at their pricing policies. And they have even assumed that we can operate more air traffic movements than we are legally allowed to operate, which makes no sense. So we will carry out a thorough review of the CAA's proposals ahead of submitting our response to the consultation before the end of the year. Our aim is to reach a settlement that enables us to give passengers a great service while operating a safe, resilient, and competitive hub airport for Britain, and ideally one that works for our airline customers as well as our investors, so that we can all focus on working together to rebuild our business, building on the good relationships developed in the last 18 months. Now I'll hand over to Javier to talk about our financial performance.
Thank you, John, and hello to everyone. I hope you and your loved ones are keeping safe and well, and I will now share with you an overview of our key financial performance starting on slide 16. As John already alluded, our financial performance continues to be materially affected by the reduced number of passengers traveling through Heathrow. In the first 9 months of this year, revenue declined by 27%, with aeronautical and retail revenue suffering the most. However, we saw positive momentum in the quarter with revenue up 45% versus the prior year. This reflects the recovery of passenger numbers due to the reopening of international travel and the steady build that we saw during the summer. Our costs were down 17%, reflecting partly the benefit of our management action to reduce our cost base implemented last year. And in the quarter, operating costs were broadly flat versus last year. After two consecutive quarters of negative EBITDA, finally we returned to positive EBITDA of 117 million. And part of that, as you can see also, is capital expenditure decreased by 67% to 148 million as we continue to constrain investment to protect our cash position. So positive EBITDA and quite control on CapEx means that our debt metrics looks well under control. We have managed to keep our net debt broadly aligned with where we were at the end of the year. And that helps in terms of benefiting our strong liquidity that continues at the end of September, with a £4.1 billion position in cash at Heathrow Finance Group, providing sufficient funds to meet all our obligations into 2025 under our current base case traffic and cash flow forecast. Let's now take a closer look at the details, starting with revenue from slide 17. Overall revenue for the period declined by 27% versus 2020 to £695 million. Aeronautical revenue declined by 39% to £325 million, largely due to reduced passenger numbers and fewer aircraft movements. On the retail, revenue declined by 38% to £122 million, driven by reduced passenger numbers as well as government's abolition of VAT policy and restrictions for non-essential shopping in the first half of the year. We continue to work with our retailers to mitigate the impact of the removal of the tax-free shopping and believe this places the UK tourism at a competitive disadvantage by making this the only country in Europe not to offer tax-free shopping. For consumers, this also represents a material adverse effect as it stops a material source of revenue that contributes and will contribute to charge increases from next year. We aim to build on the recent traffic recovery and continue to look for opportunities to optimize our revenue, particularly by maximizing traffic and cargo movements. We continue assessing contractual negotiations with concessionaires and working with retailers to offer a pre-order and collect service. Finally, other revenue increased by 11% to £248 million, mainly due to the recovery of other regulated charges and resilience in our property income. Now moving on to slide 18 for an update on our cost base. Year to date, after 9 months, operating costs are down 17% versus 2020. Whilst we have seen the benefit of the cost initiatives implemented over the last 18 months on costs given utilities prices and inflation. Our employment costs declined by 14% versus 2020, mainly due to the organizational restructure that we implemented, as well as the benefits of the government's furlough scheme. The reduction in operational, maintenance, utilities, and other costs were primarily driven by operational efficiencies, the renegotiation of supplier contracts, as well as stopping all non-essential costs. Despite a significant 83% reduction in traffic versus 2019, government business rates have remained completely flat compared to 2019, evidencing limited government support for the travel sector. Finally, part of our cost savings were offset by business resilience costs, including costs associated with the ramp-up of our operation over the summer. Looking at our operating costs going forward, and we have included some profiling on page 19. John already alluded, but as low volume is the biggest obstacle to financeability, we must protect growth and prepare our operations to ramp up ahead of demand with an inevitable cost increase. As a high fixed cost company, the earlier we can bring to high passenger volumes, the better pricing we would be able to offer to passenger customers. A large proportion of the cost savings in 2020 and 2021 were temporary, and this includes the furlough scheme benefits, staff pay reductions, and the consolidation of operations. Our operating cost base is mainly fixed and semi-fixed, with around 95% of operating costs falling into those two categories. We therefore expect an increase in operating costs associated with the ramp-up of operations during Q4 and throughout 2022. Moving into cash flows on page 20, we remain absolutely committed and focused on keeping high discipline on this area. And over the period, net debt increases slightly, from 13.1 billion to 13.3 billion by the end of September. We benefited from limiting capital expenditure and the reprofiling of the swap portfolio last year, minimizing interest paid in the period. Net cash flow from operations was 326 million, driven by a positive working capital movement as the operating cost prepayment we made at the end of last year starts to unwind. No dividends to ultimate shareholders were paid, and that will remain the case until we return to a healthier financing position and our Hydro finance gearing is back below 87.5%. Taking into account all other outflows in the period, net debt increased by £191 million. Normally, we don't comment too much about equity, but in the context of the initial proposals of the CA, it's very important that we share our views. The continuing losses from the pandemic makes the reality for equity extremely challenging. Over the last 15 years, Heathrow shareholders have injected equity over the global financial crisis, and in exchange, we distributed dividends and returned equity from disposal of non-Heathrow airports, making the total net distribution to equity over the last 15 years $3.5 billion. But with cumulative losses at the end of September from the pandemic at $3.4 billion and 3 million daily losses continuing over October, cumulative net equity flows and COVID losses are now fully offset, which means that no net equity value accretion for 15 years. Not enough to even meet annual average inflation and leaving aside embedded cost of equity theoretically granted by the CAA nor market returns. At the same time, over the last 15 years, private investment has made Heathrow a world leader in service to passengers with no cost to taxpayers and enabling material premiums to our airline partners, but leaving sizable losses to shareholders. We can say it louder, but it's impossible to be more clear. The economic regulatory model is broken, and failure from the CAA to balance risk and return as part of their 8-7 decision in early 2022 will make our service and resilience proposition completely unsustainable due to inability to attract investment to Britain's only hub airport. Moving to slide 21, we continue to monitor headroom to key ratios under our revised traffic forecast. While the headroom to gearing trigger events at Class A and Class B remains comfortable, the headroom to the covenant level at Heathrow Finance is more limited, but we remain comfortable with the position. As a reminder, the Heathrow Finance gearing covenant was revised to 93.5% in 2021 following the waiver secured in July 2020. Regarding interest cover ratios, a waiver of the Heathrow Finance SCR was successfully approved in August, and I just wanted to like to add my personal gratitude for your continued support, investors. Thank you very much. At Heathrow SP, a distribution lockup continues because of the trigger event that occurred in relation to the senior and junior interest cover ratios for 2020. This lockup will remain in place during 2021, despite the forecasted senior and junior ICR expected to be above trigger event levels. Under our base case scenario, both in terms of traffic and cash flows, we anticipate being out of the distribution lockup by mid-2022, although obviously we will need to assess that as part of our review of the CAA initial and final proposals. Finally, moving on to slide 22 to conclude the financial section of the presentation with our outlook. Our full-year outlook remains in line with our base case published in June, whilst recognizing that we continue operating with material uncertainty driven by traffic volatility as well as uncertainty associated with regulatory outcomes, having seen the initial proposals by the CAA from 2022. No covenant breaches are forecast across the wider group, and our updated financial forecast for 2021 and 2022 will be detailed in our next investor report due to be published in December. So with that, I conclude the financial review and hand back to John for closing comments. Thank you.
Thank you, Javier. So I hope you get the sense that having set out our plan in three phases at the beginning of the COVID crisis last March, we have come to an end of the first phase where it's all been about protecting the business. It's all taken much longer than any of us would have hoped, but I'm grateful for the hard work of our team, our leadership team in making some really difficult changes and improving the business and making it much more efficient, but also operating it safely over the last 18 months. And I'm also grateful for the support from both debt and equity investors in helping us to get through that most difficult period. And while it's difficult to talk about when we're still losing £3 million a day, we are now in a phase where we need to focus on the recovery. It is coming through very steadily. We can now start to plan with confidence for the recovery phase, and this is when we need to plan ahead. We need to invest for the future again and start to reinvest in both operating costs and capital ahead of the recovery. We have always known we couldn't cost cut our way to survival. We could only get there by having passengers coming back. So we've conserved as much energy and value as we could over the last 18 months, but now is the time to push for growth and recovery. And to build on the relationships that we have with all of the businesses across Heathrow, and in particular our airlines, to make sure that we all grow together as fast as we can. But I think as well as that, when the recovery phase, we are in a really good place in terms of the long term of decarbonizing aviation. And I'm very pleased with the coalition of the willing that is building up around the world to make sure that what once looked an impossible challenge is now very much mission possible. And I think the steps that IATA has taken, the steps the UK government is taking through the Jet Zero Council, COP26, and then ICAO will be a chance to get a global consensus on how we can protect the benefits of aviation in a world without carbon. So I'll now hand over to Mark to coordinate any questions from anyone on the call.
Thank you. If you wish to ask a question, please dial 01 on your telephone keypads now to enter the queue. Once your name is announced, you can ask your question. If you find it's answered before it's your turn to speak, you can dial 02 to cancel. Alternatively, if you're on the WebEx, you can type your questions in the Q&A section at the bottom right-hand corner of your screen. There'll be a brief pause now whilst we register your questions. Okay, we have a couple on the phone so far. The first is from the line of Sharon Wheaton at Columbia Threadneedle. Please go ahead. Your line is open.
Good afternoon, everyone. Thank you for the presentation. I've just got one question, actually. Perhaps could you share your thoughts on the new traffic risk-sharing mechanism, please? I mean, I wasn't so clear from the document as to how this would work and how much volume risk you would actually be carrying. And does this only apply in particular circumstances, for example, or is this something that Heathrow wears throughout a price control period? Perhaps could you explain that to us a little bit? That would be great. Thank you.
Yes, and if I may, with the with all of the building blocks for the new settlement, we are still just getting our heads around exactly what they mean and how
sure.
they all work together. And it's not clear that they do all work together.
So
that might be something we'd be better to follow up once we have had a chance to complete our assessment. But we will share any insights that we have on what the intent is of the CAA's proposals as soon as we are able to.
Okay.
So I'm sorry, I can't say much more than that. But it's
okay. All right. We wait for that.
You know,
all right, John.
It's 300 pages of quite complex material, and I don't want to misspeak on any of that.
Okay.
Thanks, Sharon.
Thank you. Our next question comes from the line of Stephanie Foster at AllianceBernstein. Please go ahead. Your line is open.
Hello, everyone. Thanks very much for the presentation. That's been really helpful. I just wanted to get a point of clarity, actually. As you're going through the presentation, we can see recovery seems to be building, confidence is improving, et cetera. But then when I read the press release, it talks about that traffic is not expected to recover to 2019 levels until at least 2026. And I think most of the data points I've seen on recovery up until this point, including IATA, have been 2024. So I just wondered if you could talk to that sort of two-year extension, if you like, on expectations to get back to 2019 levels.
Yes, I mean, you'll know that forecasting over the last 18 months has been a bit of a fool's game. And
yeah.
Consistently over the last 18 months, we have probably been the most cautious with our forecasts. We've been the most accurate, but having said that, whenever we've done a major reforecast, our worst case scenario has always become our base case.
Mm-hmm.
That's started to change now. I think the latest forecast we put out is pretty solid. We're currently about 1 million passengers behind where we thought we'd be at this stage, but October is pretty much bang in line with our forecast. So we feel that we've now got a fairly solid database. There is a lot of, but I think there is a lot of optimism bias out there with a lot of the other forecasts that we're seeing. And we tend to think that the UK is now open, and therefore you'd expect to get back to normal quite quickly. That kind of feels quite instinctive. But when you look at that chart of which markets are actually open at which end and what the requirements are, there isn't anywhere that you can fly to without having to take a test or fill out a form from the UK, and that's one of the more liberal countries in the world. And it will take a long time to get all of those markets completely open again. And even places like Hong Kong are still closed. And when I spoke to them a couple of days ago, they don't expect to open up until maybe for another 4 to 6 months. So the recovery and the removal of restrictions is going to be slower. And even when countries open up, they won't be open up necessarily without restrictions. When the US announced their reopening plans yesterday, they still require a pre-departure test, even for vaccinated passengers. And of course, if you're unvaccinated, you have a bigger challenge on being allowed in. So it's the steady progress to remove all of these restrictions that really dictate how long it will take us to get back to where we were. And that's a difficult thing to map out, but I think experience has shown that it's best to be to err on the side of caution with those things. We should also bear in mind that the COVID hasn't gone away, and the Morocco example is a sign that some of the restrictions that we think have been lifted could come back again. And we've seen the Netherlands, I think, put restrictions on the UK as well. So I think it is going to be a little bit bumpy. Overall, I think we'll see a steady progress, but that's really why we see 2026 rather than 2024.
Thank you for clarity.
Would be in terms of passenger mix, what I've been pleasantly surprised by is how many business passengers have come back. And if you remember, 18 months ago, we all thought that we'd spend our lives on Zoom. And after 18 months of living on Zoom, we've all decided that's not such a good idea. And so on a Monday morning, you'll see people as you used to with a wheelie trolley ready to go away for a week traveling around the world. I've been to two big conferences in the last couple of weeks, Global Investment Summit last week. People just couldn't wait to get back and meet one another in person. And it's probably conferences that we all thought we would be doing by Zoom in the future rather than face-to-face, but actually there is no better way to have the meetings that you just can't organize by Zoom. And so I think life will be more normal than we perhaps thought it would be a year or so ago.
But it just might take a bit longer to get there.
Yeah, I think so. And I mean, you know that we are a prudent organisation, and we would much rather manage our finances on a prudent basis. We've been disappointed too often in the past by over forecasting, not just through the pandemic, but if you go back to Q5, passenger forecasts that we had then were just unachievable. And we think here we have a balanced forecast that we can plan for. But I would love it to be quicker. And actually, going back to Sharon's earlier question about the risk-sharing mechanism, I think we support having a risk-sharing mechanism. We had proposed it should be based on revenue rather than on just passenger numbers. But it's quite a complicated mechanism that the CAA has proposed. So we're just trying to understand that in a bit more detail before we share our views on that.
Okay, great. That's really helpful, John. Thank you.
Thanks, Stephanie.
Thank you. Our next question comes from the line of Paul Dew at Fidelity. Please go ahead. Your line is open.
Hey, Paul.
Hi, John. Thank you very much for the presentation. It's very helpful, and it's great to see all the work that's being done on the ESG as well. Three questions, if I may. Just on the retail spending, is it too early to be able to analyse the impact of the government's decision on VAT? I appreciate, obviously, we're only in the early days of the recovery, but any thoughts there would be helpful. And then on the cash flow breakdown that you gave on slide 20, I was just wondering if you could give some more insight into the accretion and other block and what we should expect going forward out of that. And then the final question, just on liquidity, what do you kind of need to see to maybe not keep such a high level of liquidity? Or is this something that you will be keeping given, as you mentioned, the recovery isn't over and COVID hasn't gone away, sadly? Thank you very much.
All good questions. Javi, would you like to pick those three up?
Yeah. So I think in terms of retail revenue, as you mentioned, Paul, I think it's early to conclude because there are so many moving pieces that it's very difficult to isolate what's the impact from VAT. I think just as a reference, in our revised business plan for the next 5 years, we have estimated to lose around £200 million per year in absolute terms, which when you compare that with average £60 million over the queue, represents around £2 to £3 in terms of subsidy to passenger journeys. Your second question in terms of cash flow, I think within that we have a combination of things. But effectively, what we have is a combination of bond accretion related with impact of LIBOR, as well as swap inflation accretion across our swaps and bonds portfolio. So as you know, to hedge exposure to inflation, some of our net debt is directly or indirectly through swaps linked to inflation, which means that we are a big proportion of our cost, we only pay real prices and we accrue that and we accrete in our net cash flow as well as in our gearing. So I think it mainly is the impact of inflation on our swap portfolio. Obviously, with the increases in inflation we have seen in the last few months, I think overall inflation is positive for a regulated industry like us, where we see on the one hand the uplift in RAB values as well as increases in surplus that you might have seen in our results associated with our defined benefit pension scheme as well as investment properties. But on the other hand, we are not fully linked to inflation and therefore we have seen some mark-to-market and accretion related with inflation. So hopefully that gives you, Paul, some color of what's behind that.
And have you in terms of liquidity?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. On the liquidity, yeah. So we look. I think it's naturally cautious to hold a bit more liquidity than normal when this traffic volatility remains. I think that in the past we have been sizing our revolving credit facilities based on both the size of the RAB as well as the capital expenditure going forward. So in the next few years, we will refinance our revolving credit facilities, and obviously we will take into consideration what are the future plans in terms of capital expenditure as well as RAB size, and we will take a view at that point in time in terms of what should be the size of our revolving credit facilities, which ultimately is a fundamental lever to drive liquidity. So hopefully, Paul, that gives you some color.
Thank you. It's very helpful.
Thanks, Paul.
Thank you. We currently have one further question on the line. So just as a reminder to participants, if you do wish to ask a question, either dial 01 on your telephone keypads to ask a question verbally, or you can type it on the Q&A section at the bottom right-hand corner of the WebEx. That last question so far from the phones is from the line of Arnaud Bourgois of Amundi Asset Management. Please go ahead. Your line is open.
Yes. Good afternoon. I have a question. You mentioned that the economic model was broken and there is some question about the financeability going forward of Heathrow. I understand there is sort of a battle between equity shareholders and the CA regarding how the balance sheet repair is going to happen. Can you give us an indication what is the state of mind of the equity shareholders at the moment and how they expect the balance sheet to be repaired going forward?
Well, if I can give an overview and then have Sally, please feel free to add in. I think it's fair to say they're feeling bruised. The whole RAB-based model assumes that you get a return of the RAB. Anything that's efficiently invested will come back to you. And you get a fair bet of a return on the RAB. And what we've seen over the last 18 months is that we haven't even had the return of the RAB. And that really, I think, undermines the whole principle of the RAB-based regulation. And that is going to be used for the new Sizewell nuclear facility. And I'm sure that investors will want to look at what's happening with Heathrow and make sure that they are protected against that kind of loss of capital value when they're making an investment. is not good enough to have equity being lured in with the promise of return off the RAB and return on the RAB, and then what feels like being punished once you've made the investment. And although the regulatory cycle is only 5 years, that's why it's important that this next 5 years gives equity a fair bet. So we will still make the case for a repair of the regulated asset base based on what's happened with COVID. So although we've only had £300 million recovered so far, we will push for the remainder of that and make our case. But we will also be pushing for a better balanced settlement going forward. And you'll see from some of the examples I've given that the CAA's numbers just don't make sense. And if they were to impose that, this would not be financeable for an equity. So there's a lot of work to be done there to make sure we have something that works for everyone.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, John. I think just to add a couple of points. I think we were very clear in our submission of our revised business plan that we understand perfectly the challenge that the CAA might be facing to try to balance as well as possible affordability to consumers with financeability. I think sometimes we are as an organization, as an airport, we are the first ones who are keen to continue and to grow our consumer base as quickly as possible, because that's the root cause of the problem that we are facing these days. But in the proposal that we put forward, we calibrated very carefully how much cash, what was the minimum cash flow that we had to generate over the quinquennium to protect debt financeability. I think it's fantastic that the CAA have recognized that inevitably prices will have to go up. But I think at this stage, there are points within the range provided by the CAA that will not deliver on the minimum cash flow required to protect debt financeability. And I think it's important that we are transparent with debt capital markets that's the case. From an investability perspective, as John mentioned, the fundamental concern here is that the pandemic losses are so huge that are not offset by recovery of losses, that actually the terminal value of any projection in terms of returns is simply throwing equity into negative returns in real terms, irrespectively of which point of the price range that the CAA was suggesting. So from an equity perspective, it's critical that the CAA reconsider their position on RAP recovery, because without that, it makes little incentive or no incentive to continue investing in capital across the airport. Obviously, in terms of your question about the stance from individual shareholders, we will reserve to individual shareholders to give their own views.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you. And we've had one further question come through on the phone line. So that's from the line of Alessandro Lascalia of BlackRock. Please go ahead. Your line is open.
Yes, hi, hello everybody, and thanks for this presentation. I have a few questions all on the regulatory review, essentially. Well, now, I understand your point about asking compensation in terms of RAB adjustment, because clearly without that, equity investors will getting essentially a zero or negative IRR on their investment. But I wanted to ask, were you entitled to receive such an adjustment? Because my understanding is that under the existing CAA regulation, well, you are essentially fully exposed to traffic risk. So now the fact that they are for the next regulatory period coming with a traffic risk sharing mechanism that actually looks similar to what other airports have, at least I can think about one, which is Rome Fiumicino with the ADR group. It seems actually good news in terms of how the future balance will be for any kind of investors looking at Heathrow. And essentially, what I'm trying to understand, essentially, if you're asking for an adjustment to the RAB, was grounded in existing regulation or was essentially due to a sort of more general fairness principle in investment that you wanted CAA to comply with. Then again, maybe too early to comment about the numbers in the initial proposal that CAA published. But I was wondering, I mean, there was a comment from Javier, I think, you say at certain points this may become a problem also for debt financeability, unsustainable for debt financeability. What that means exactly? Are you saying that there are points to within what the CAA published in its documents where the debt cannot be funded at IG level, for instance? Are we looking at a situation where you expect a serious deterioration in your credit? Because if you look at numbers, unless they are completely unrealistic, unless they're asking you to deliver much more than you could with those figures, thinking about a 2.4 billion CapEx plan, for instance, you're still looking at important increases in your aviation fees, and airlines are very unhappy about that, by the way. So what does it mean exactly from a debt perspective? I totally get the equity point, but I wanted you to delve a little bit more on to which extent what CAA is proposing would be non-financial from a debt perspective. Thank you.
Great. Well, thank you. Let me cover the first part of that, and then perhaps ask Cavi to cover the second part about debt financing. So when we agreed the Q6 regulatory settlement back in 2014, we asked then for a risk-sharing mechanism, and the CAA said they didn't want to put one in, but they put in a clause that said that in exceptional circumstances, they would reopen the settlement. And we have been through exceptional circumstances, which the CAA has recognized. So the question then is, what are they going to do in those exceptional circumstances? Well, there are clearly models for how to make an adjustment. They could have reopened the entire settlement. They could have adopted the kind of risk share mechanism they already have with NATS. And that's effectively what we have asked them to look at. And our argument is that you have to go back to first principles of making sure that the overall asset is financeable. And you fulfill those two important principles of return off the RAB and return on the RAB. So the bare minimum, what I would expect, is that regulatory depreciation would have been suspended for 2020 and 2021 when we weren't able to recover regulatory depreciation through revenues in the way that you normally would. And that's even before we start to think about the exceptional losses that have been made during that period. And that's a really important building block, because unless you can recover efficiently incurred investment, then the ability to invest in the future is undermined. You've got no confidence you're going to get that money back in the future. And that really starts to unpick the entire regulated asset-based model. So that's a fundamental issue that we think the CAA has just not got right so far. And we will continue to make our case on that, and there is room for us to appeal around that point. And that's important because, looking forward, at times like this when we see a downturn in revenue, it's the worst time in many ways to start putting prices up, and we should be using the regulatory tools at our disposal to help to smooth the impact over a longer period of time. Deferring regulatory depreciation from one period to the next, putting assets onto the balance sheet rather than trying to capitalize them, which is really the basis of the new risk-sharing model that the CAA is proposing. But if you've got no confidence you're ever going to see that back in cash, then why would you use it? And I think that is a fundamental issue that the CAA just hasn't got to grips with yet, because there's no point in having a risk-sharing mechanism if we've got no guarantee that any deferred income is actually going to come back to us at some period in the future. So this needs to be resolved as part of this settlement. And if the CAA doesn't correct the situation for 2020-2021, I don't see how they can use regulatory depreciation as a lever in future periods. In terms of overall pricing, I mean, I've been doing media interviews today. It's a difficult thing to argue that increasing your charge from around £20 to around £30 isn't enough. But when you look at the mechanics of the regulatory model, and you look at some of the assumptions that the CAA has put in, and I've touched on some of the inconsistencies and things that just don't make sense. Actually, the £30 isn't enough to run a safe and resilient and good level of service for the business while continuing to invest in the future development of the airport. And we're going to need to see some significant changes from what has been proposed in order to make it financeable. That's a very difficult thing to say because it sounds like a big increase, but it's not financeable, and that's one of the fundamental responsibilities of the CAA. But Javi, would you like to pick up the point about
debt financeability? Yeah, well, Alessandro, I think that this is the consequences of this are very complex, but actually the problem is very simple, and it's a mathematical problem. You know that our debt financeability is underpinned by our ability to maintain a minus rating, as simple as that. And credit rating agencies are comfortable maintaining rating consistently over several periods if we can deliver on credit metrics. The one that we have been very clear that we are really facing challenges from next year is about cash flow generation metrics. How much cash you can generate when compared with your notional structure, leaving aside our actual structure. I think credit rating agencies have very clear policies about what's the minimum FFO to debt that you have to deliver consistently. And there are points within the ranges provided by the CAA that we simply struggle to see how we can deliver on those FFO to debt metrics over a long enough period that credit rating agencies can remain comfortable to maintain our credit ratings, which means that financeability of even debt could be compromised under certain ranges, low ranges, within the CAA forecast. Obviously, the CAA in their proposals have suggested that all the ranges are financeable, but obviously they only reach those conclusions by including certain projections on traffic, revenue, and cost that, as John mentioned, we simply, common sense suggests that they are simply not feasible at all. So when we overlay revenue, cost, and traffic projections to what we think is the minimum feasible, then the cash flow provided by the CAA under certain ranges is not enough, and therefore we will struggle to maintain A-minus ratings if the CAA were going to maintain some of those ranges in their final proposals.
If I may add something, I mean, it's two follow-ups, actually. The first one is on what John was saying, and that's, my understanding is that in the numbers that CAA is proposing, the big issue is on the OPEX side. The OPEX allowance is definitely...
Alessandro, we cannot hear you.
Yeah, so the line is still connected. I don't know if he's gone on mute or if he's lost reception.
Let's wait a few seconds so he can reconnect. Because obviously we welcome every challenge possible.
Okay, well, we're coming up to the hour, and I don't want to keep people too long, but there are clearly some important questions on the regulatory proposals from the CAA that we're still getting our heads around, and and where you want to get our views on them. So as we have completed our assessment, we will share with you what we know. We'll clearly be doing that formally with the CAA towards the end of the year, and if we can do that with you earlier than that, then of course we will. And so if I can ask you to follow up with Sally and her team, we'll keep you as up-to-date as we can with our latest assessment of what the CAA is proposing at this stage. But
John, also, if I may have a suggestion, I think as we have done in previous results presentation, these questions are critical. And I think that in the spirit of transparency, as soon as we can follow up with Alessandro, we will publish in our investor site Alessandro's question as well as with our answer. So we maintain our commitment on full transparency.
Excellent. Good. Thank you for that, Javier. So please do follow up with Sally and her team if you have any further questions, and we will share those answers with the full group. Thanks again for your support, and thanks for taking the time to join with us this afternoon.
This now concludes the conference. Thank you all very much for attending. You may now disconnect.